The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Nations League relegation drama. England, Italy, France and Wales. Big nations facing the drop. And Wales. In the final international break before the big thing in Qatar, we check out the weekend's key Nations League matchups and decide we'd rather be watching Brazil-Ghana. Also today, how tall is Ivan Toney? Does it matter if rice is off the boil? And while all those internationals are going on, have WSL cleverly scheduled their best set of fixtures ever? All that and more coming up in this Totally Football Show. Thursday, 22nd of Czechs Note September. Hey, listener. Thanks for joining us. Thought you might have other things, you know, because it's international break. But here you are. Here we are. We, in this case, being me, Carl Anker. Hey, Carl.
Ahoy, ahoy, James.
Yep. Colin Miller's with us as well. Hello, Colin.
Hello, James.
Indeed. And Tom Williams, too. All right, Tom.
Hi, James.
Excellent. Later on. Not that much later, we'll have James Horncastle and also Charlotte Harper will be joining us too. Super. International weekend, traditionally a little bit of a gear shift from the kind of hot magma narrative spewing volcano that is club football. I'm curious to know what are the big storylines of the international type that are most interesting you. What are you going to watch this weekend? What are you looking out for? Tom, you go first.
I will, as ever, be keeping a close eye on matters French and also matters Welsh. France and Wales are playing at the same time this evening, Thursday, and then again at the weekend, so going to have to be a bit of split-screen action. Looking forward to seeing how France cope with this spectacular injury glut, which has robbed them of at least six, possibly seven regular first-team players. Interested to see how Wales are looking. Less than 2 months out now from the World Cup. And after a really positive summer in terms of World Cup qualification, but a slightly disappointing summer then in terms of Nations League results. Plenty to be looking out for.
Right, and it's Michael Sheen's first game in charge as well, so that'll be interesting too.
Yeah, well, actually, I think Gareth Bale was asked about this in the press conference yesterday. This, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is Michael Sheen's remarkable patriotic rallying cry from, was it a League of Their Own that he was on or something like that? A kind of 2-minute monologue of all that is, you know, that is great about Wales and Welsh football.
A song of hope, a song of courage, a victory song that floats through the valleys like a red mist, rolls over the mountaintops like crimson thunder. A red storm is coming to the gates of Qatar. It crackles with the spirit of 58 and Jimmy Murphy's boys. It turns the pages of the history books and finds Rob's page, waiting, still to be written. What would you write in there, boys? Dare you write your names on that page?
Someone sent me the link and I thought, okay, well, you know, this is obviously going to be a little bit twee and a little bit forced maybe. But it was genuinely quite a moving little speech. And there can't be a Welsh person on the planet who has not had that video pop up in a WhatsApp chat at some point over the last week. And it turns out the same for the Wales players' WhatsApp group. Gareth Bale said he'd been sent it by about 100 different people. And the lads in the...
That's the entire population, of course.
I mean, not far off. And the lads in the changing room have been enjoying it. So maybe, even though I'm not sure Michael Sheen will be there in person ahead of the game against Belgium this evening, I wouldn't be surprised if his dulcet tones made an appearance at some point pre-match.
Wow. Well, it was extraordinary. As you say, my expectations were one thing and what followed was just... It made me want to be Welsh. Colin.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. What are you hot for this weekend?
Well, as Tom was talking about France and Wales, I would swap that for Spain and Northern Ireland, as usual. But maybe with Northern Ireland, I'm not so much looking forward to their games. the recent form that they've been on, or the form they've been on for a number of years now, makes that not quite as an attractive prospect as it might have been not so long ago.
And Northern Ireland on the brink of relegation to level D.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously Northern Ireland had been relegated from Group B down to Group C for this year, and the expectation was that they should be really challenging to win that group and to go back up again with Greece, but they've really, really struggled. I mean, they really have been appalling in that group. They've got Cyprus and Kosovo as well, and they sort of scrambled a last-minute equaliser at home to Cyprus in their last match, which sort of saved them the ignominy of being bottom of the group going into this run of games, so... The manager, Ian Barraclough, is under real pressure to turn things around there. The group of players that he has, they just don't have that quality, that experience that you really need at this level. So, yeah, things are looking pretty bleak in that sort of outlook. But, I mean, the Nations League in general, I know it gets a bit of a bad rep, and, you know, the international breaks generally get a bit of a bad rep during the season, but I find a lot of these games very interesting. I think it's a very good way of just sort of measuring where these teams are, because they're playing teams of a comparable quality. You know, you don't have games like England against Andorra or San Marino. I mean, you're playing teams who are in the top tier of European football. So it's really interesting just to see where the sides are in this moment. And the Spanish team as well, of course, have got a very good chance of winning their group. They're sort of going head-to-head with Portugal. So I think there's definitely quite a lot to keep an eye on over the coming week or so.
Excellent. San Marino, who you mentioned, were involved in a game already this week. The lowest ranked team in the world, 211th by FIFA's measures, who were attempting to end a 122-game winless streak. They faced the Seychelles, who flew 4,000 miles for this friendly. It finished 0-0. Carl, what's on your agenda for this weekend? It's Ghana-Brazil, isn't it?
It is Ghana-Brazil on Friday. Played in Paris, which is quite enjoyable. The Brazil national team are just absolutely stacked with attacking talent now. If you're a fan of the sticker book collection, I think you'll be in awe of just how good and how well-storied that Brazil page will be for Qatar 2022. But Ghana, they've got a very interesting thing. Obviously, we've spoken previously about how they've got a number of dual national players to switch allegiances. So this will be the first real test for a number of those internationals. This might be Tarek Lamptey's first debut in a Ghana shirt. There's also Mohamed Kudus, who's something of the star of the moment. If you've been watching Champions League football for Ajax, his goal record in the Champions League right now is incredible. He's that very rare thing in that a Ghanaian player who absolutely seems natural at attacking football. Historically, we tend to make very good defensive midfielders and slightly erratic wingers. But Kudus, who originally came through Ajax's system as a 10, then became more of a box-to-box style player under Erik ten Hag, and now seems to be just relishing this role as a false nine or even out-and-out nine. On the new Ajax regime. So he will be something of a superstar for the national team going forward. I'm also really interested in the Netherlands game against Poland, which is going ahead on Thursday night, because there is something about this Dutch team that, while not necessarily thrilling, is beginning to emit all the glow of a team that manages to get to the World Cup quarterfinals and knocks out a heavy hit without you even really noticing how they've done it.
Ooh. All right, Netherlands currently top of Group 4, as you know, listener. That same group that has Wales in last place on 1 point and staring down the barrel of relegation. They're not the only ones. Quick check on the key games on the way. Thursday, you've also got France-Austria. The world champions are battling relegation in the Nations League. Belgium taking on Wales and Netherlands-Poland. Friday, Italy-England, which is literally a relegation 6-pointer for those two nations at San Siro. There's also some intriguing friendlies on Friday. Iran-Uruguay and also Brazil-Ghana. Saturday, how about Scotland against Republic of Ireland, and in the WSL, the North London Derby. And Sunday, Wales again, this time against Poland. In the WSL, you've got Merseyside Derby and Chelsea Man City. Woof. Scotland, who've already been in action Thursday night, they beat Ukraine 3-0. More on that to come. We begin with England and their trip to San Siro.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Italy, England, everybody, San Siro.
Crikey. Rematch of the Euro final. 14 months ago, both teams coming off big defeats in June. England 4-0 against Hungary, Italy 5-2 to Germany. That Hungary game was England's heaviest home defeat in 94 years. Just to refresh your memory of these things, England now haven't won in 6 months, have only scored one goal in their last four games. Crikey. Carl, as an Englishman, what in Gareth's squad should I be outraged about?
I'll put a big asterisk on the Hungary defeat, as that 11 was missing a number of personnel. Uh-huh. And the Conor Gallagher experiment doesn't work in this England national team. I think Southgate's challenge in this Nations League game is he's got a missing Calvin Phillips, who is very important, a Declan Rice, who is slightly off the boil, and Harry Maguire, who has often been the defensive linchpin and really important to ball carrying, is also in horrendous form as well. So, big game. A number of your key lieutenants aren't there. Slightly nervous. I think one of the big things that a lot of England fans are annoyed about is the slightly prosaic midfield and the continued reliance on Mason Mount. Mount has been a Southgate favourite for a very long time. He's really important for his ability off the ball. So when England play a 3-4-3, Mount plays a sort of quasi eight, or who moves to a number 10 when they start attacking. And his job is basically to disrupt the deepest lying midfielder on the other team. So in the Euro final, Mount was supposed to stop Jorginho and really get under the skin of Verratti. And he did it for about 30 minutes. And then it became a whole mess as Kyle Walker basically had to keep being a cheat code and bail him out. Verratti might not play for Italy this weekend. So that is less important, but this is a big game for Mason Mount. I think his stock with Southgate will remain high, but his stock among the England fan base is quite low. And when you have players like Jude Bellingham coming through, when there are players who are not in the current squad at the moment, but someone like Harvey Elliott, who I'm particularly high on, there is increasingly a conversation about, why Mount instead of player X, because player X is always better when they're not actually playing England shirt. So yeah, I think this will be a big test for him.
One of the things that stands out from this England squad is that there's 12 defenders that have been named, and if you look at the various combinations that Southgate has used in the Nations League, he's obviously tried to change things up a bit, because he doesn't seem to really know what his best back four are. And obviously, in the Euros, he had that quite a settled defence, and you had Maguire and Shaw both being named in the team of the tournament. And at that time, it really seemed like they were on top of their game. And that was only 14 months ago, that tournament. But so much has changed for both of those players, for a lot of the other players too. Obviously, they've tried to integrate that Tomori into the squad after his fantastic form of Milan. But Connor Cody, who's sort of had a bit of a resurgence at Everton, and then is John Stones, is he going to be a starter? Is Eric Dyer? He's obviously been on good form for Tottenham, but Southgate, he's chopped and changed throughout this campaign. I think that explains some of the bad results. It certainly explains the result against Hungary. And even then, with Jordan Pickford out injured at the minute, and who's going to be the goalkeeper? It seems to be Aaron Ramsdale's preferred, but then Dean Henderson and Nick Pope, they're both pushing as well. And I think over these next couple of games, we're really going to see Southgate experiment a little bit, because this, I think he's a coach who tends to be risk averse, certainly in big tournaments. He likes to know exactly what his formation is going into that. But at the moment, there just seems to be a bit of a period of flux, especially in those defensive positions. And it's just going to be really interesting to see if he can stumble across his preferred combination ahead of the finals. And obviously, you talked about Maguire and Shaw. I mean, they're just not playing for Man United. Can they be regulars at a major tournament when they're not playing at club level? It'll be interesting to see how he balances that.
I can't believe that this was England's last game. It feels like it happened about a year ago. Feels like it belongs to a different age. Or is that just because I pay slightly less attention to England results than England fans? I don't know. It just feels like it's so long ago, that game, and yeah. England getting booed off and Gareth Southgate being jeered by fans of the team that he'd led to a major final, about less than 10 months previously. But yeah, I mean, I guess the really fascinating thing about these two Nations League matches And I join Colin in saying that I'm, you know, I quite enjoy the Nations League despite the bad press it gets. And I think it was unfortunate that you had those four games tacked on at the end of last season, which was clearly just a disastrous idea and a really poor advert for the competition. But given that they are the last opportunity, not just for national coaches to experiment, but for the players to spend any sort of time together before the World Cup begins, you know, this is basically it. This is the last look we're going to get at all of these teams before the World Cup begins. And so you would have thought at some point in one of these two games, at the very least, Southgate will want to put out the team, or as close to the team as possible, that is going to start England's opening game. And I suspect that'll be the case for all the, you know, for all the nations who, you know, who've got Nations League games this week. So yeah, I mean, at the moment, there is an awful lot of uncertainty about England. And I suspect within the next few days, we'll get a clear idea of what that starting 11 is going to look like.
Crikey. On the positive note for England, Matt Knight says, just how sensational is that new England away kit for the World Cup with the kind of blue fade on? No, Carl, not for you?
So I've got a piece on The Athletic coming shortly about the England kits. And the away kit, I am aware of the 30-year nostalgia cycle and how marketers are very good at offering me the... Now I'm an adult. Marketers now want to sell me idealized versions of things I remember as a child.
Right.
So I can understand why this...
Got to say, I've got some skin in this game, but you keep going.
I can understand why this England away kit is popular, because it, you know, harks back to Italia 90 and whatnot. But it's just missing... something.
Really?
I've now seen it with a number of
blood
on. Well, apparently it's called the shade
they
is referred to as Challenge
little,
Red.
They should sell it with a bloodied Terry Butcher headband. You should be able to accessorize it with like your kind of item of choice from that era.
Yeah both England kits have they don't move me, unfortunately.
Okay, what about Ivan Toney?
That moves me greatly. I'm really enjoying his current slate of interviews. He speaks with a great happiness that he is at the England camp, but also with a strong hunger that he wants to prove that it wasn't a fluke and he intends to be there for a long time. I also enjoyed how he responded to the ire of certain Arsenal fans after that victory. I liked how Ivan Toney has taken that in stride and went, yeah, you know, it's a bit cringy that I'm living rent-free. Well, I'm paraphrasing and being meaner than what he said, but I quite enjoyed that as well. Big fan of Ivan Toney. I'm very unconvinced he is the height he is billed at.
Oh.
Apparently he's billed at 5'10", which feels wrong.
Okay. You think he's...
Tom
shorter?
Is pulling a face here, see?
No, I kind of feel like... I wonder whether it's because he plays with players who are... like Brian Mbeumo is obviously a bit shorter than him. Or is he? I mean, I say that. Is this all just nonsense? I wonder whether he is made to look taller by dint of playing with shorter than average teammates. I will investigate.
You think he's taller, Carl, than 5'10"?
Ivan Toney has the aura and plays like a man who's 6 foot. And the thing that confused me quite a bit was he during Brentford's victory over Manchester United, he was stood next to Luke Shaw. Luke Shaw is billed at 6'1", which I've always felt quite confused by. And there was a point where they were stood next to each other and I could have sworn they were the same height and I had no idea what height that was. So England, heights,
so
very odd.
I've looked into it and I can reveal that Brian Mbeumo is 5'7", and that Johan Wisse, Ivan Toney's other occasional strike partner, is 5'9". So both slightly on the short side for a professional player. And I wonder whether that, Carl, is what makes you think Ivan Toney looks taller than he actually is.
That could be it.
As I mentioned, England only one goal in the last four games. What about opponents Italy? Since the Euro final, they managed to stuff up World Cup participation by losing at home to a representative 11 from North Macedonia. So what kind of adversary are they going to be this time? James Horncastle joins us now. Hello, James.
Are they tall enough?
We're
going to find out. Yeah. It's a little bit like you, James. You know, people are listening to you and the aura that you project in podcasts. They would imagine you come out of the booth 7 feet tall and instead you're only 6'8". So there we go.
It's true, but let's talk about Italy, James. They'd won 15 games in a row up until last summer. Now they've only won 4 of their last 14. What kind of form are they in?
The spell is broken. I mean, since the finalissima at Wembley at the end of the season when the champions of Europe played the champions of South America and the champions of South America handed it to them, Mancini has tried to usher a new generation into the national team. He's like, we have to draw a line under the old generation, and that is why I've called up Manolo Gabbiadini to play against England. Gabbiadini is back after 5 years.
What happened the last time he was in the Italy side?
I imagine they failed to qualify for the World Cup.
Yeah, at San Siro. At San Siro, where they're going to be on for... Oh, my goodness. Mm.
He also made his Italy debut, James, against England, and Italy lost. So there we go.
Oh, right. There is a first... Well, there's a couple of fresh keepers in there in the squad. There's also a player who I think we've enjoyed so far this season, Salernitana's Pasquale Mazzocchi, who's tremendous fun, although possibly won't see too much game time because of the return of Spinazzola.
No, Spinazzola basically called Mancini and said, I'm really sorry, Roberto, I can't make it. I've got an injury. He hasn't been in the best of form as well for Roma. So Spinazzola, who was such a difference maker for Italy during the European Championship up until the quarterfinals, just hasn't really been available since then. And I think some people will point to that and say, you know, the special sauce has gone with him. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why Italy could not take advantage of their dominance in games against Switzerland in the World Cup qualifiers and couldn't beat North Macedonia in that playoff semi-final. So Mazzocchi, I mean, he delivered arguably the best initiation song rendition that has been sung at Coverciano in decades. He was quite the performer. He sung a Neapolitan neo-melodic song. And this guy has got some pipes on him. Incredible stuff from him, if you're into that, which not many people outside of Naples are, but it went down very well.
Was it too good, did you feel?
Yeah. I felt he's almost a better singer than he is a footballer, James.
Really?
That was my worry. But no, Mazzocchi's been excellent so far this season. And I think him coming into the side has, certainly in some of the days leading up to this game, led Mancini to experiment with a 3-5-2. So finally breaking away from the 4-3-3, which has been a big part of his tenure as national team manager. But as the game gets closer, it does look like Mancini will be playing that 4-3-3. They're playing at San Siro, which kind of indicates how big a game this is for Italy, because they've only lost 3 times there. Their points per game record is 2.2, but of course we remember that Sweden playoff, which didn't go very well. I think more recently the game against Spain in the Nations League, which was kind of revenge for Italy beating Spain in the Euros as well. And, you know, frankly, you mentioned the fresh call-ups. There's very little freshness about this Italy squad, really. The under-21s looks more exciting, and it's a surprise that Mancini, who's usually so precocious about sort of promoting players, he hasn't really done that in this squad. And he hasn't even called up Nicolò Zaniolo. And Zaniolo is back healthy after the shoulder injury he suffered against Cremonese, and by all accounts it's quite surprised that he isn't in this squad and wasn't called up when the likes of Politano and Pellegrini got injured. So
why do you think that is, James? Is it a personal issue?
I mean, he looked like he was back to his best earlier in the season, and certainly played in the last game against Atalanta. He did dive in that game and wanted a penalty. And that's kind of led Mourinho to lose his mind and get sent off. We've seen previous Italy managers look quite dimly on players behaving like that. But given Mancini used to behave like that as a player, I don't think it would be something that would get in the way of him calling Zaniolo up. So it is a bit of a surprise, just because if they are going to continue playing 4-3-3, then he's someone who's tended to play on the right occasionally in that system. He can play in midfield as well. I'm also surprised to see Fabio Miretti, who's been playing for Juventus, one of the few bright sparks about Juventus this season, still playing for the under-21s, because I thought he probably would have got a call up and would have made this midfield, which will, as I think Carl mentioned, is going to be without Verratti, and I think maybe without Locatelli as well, look a little bit fizzier, I suppose, than it does at the moment.
James, I have a question about Mancini and this. What, in your sense, is the sort of public opinion about Mancini? Because obviously, came in, had that incredible unbeaten run, had the incredible Euro success, but in that World Cup qualifying group, I mean, they were poor. They seemed to be a team who kind of ran out of ideas in a lot of the games, who seemed a bit blunt in attack, and obviously that sort of continued on a little bit into the Nations League. Is Mancini under any sort of pressure in his position, or is there a sense that maybe there's just shortcomings within the squad of players that he has, and there's a trust that he'll get it right eventually?
I think it came so soon after the Euros that he had all of the credit in the bank from putting Italy back where they belong historically. And I think there was a little bit of a Euros hangover in their first World Cup qualifiers, particularly against Bulgaria in Florence, where they had, I don't know, 40 shots and didn't take their chances and ended up drawing that game. But I mean, even against Switzerland, Jorginho has a penalty at home and away from home, and he misses those penalties. And if that's the fine margins, you know, if those go in, then they qualify as group winners. They don't have to go through a playoff. Apart from the impact of that defeat to North Macedonia, which people weren't expecting that, no matter how kind of underwhelming they'd been in World Cup qualifying, they expected Italy to go out in the playoff final against Portugal. There was a real feeling that it didn't really matter what happened against North Macedonia, because Portugal were going to be too good and were going to beat Italy away from home in Porto. I mean, that's why I didn't go to the game in Palermo against North Macedonia. I was sent to Porto to cover Portugal against Italy, and instead it was Portugal against North Macedonia. So there was already a feeling that if they didn't qualify automatically, they weren't going to make it through the playoffs, and thus that's what happened.
A fire engine going to the wrong fire, James.
Yes.
Speaking of which, James, this Friday you're not going to San Siro, are you? You're going to be at Ghana, Brazil instead. I have to say, great choice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to following Brazil, Argentina, I think, for the Athletic. So been catching up on Brazil over the last few years. I've watched all their Copa America games from 2021. No Gabriel Jesus, no Gabriel Martinelli. No. I know that's been,
right.
Tite has lost it already, so there we go. If you lose Arsenal Twitter, there's no coming back from it, James.
Yeah, indeed. And worse still, there is a call-up for Spurs' Richarlison amongst an array of attacking talent. Vinicius Jr., of course, Rafinha, Antony, Rodrigo, Neymar. Who do you think is going to start up top? All of them?
Well, I mean, if it's anything like the Copa America, I mean, Richarlison was featured in more or less every game in that. And it was... It's just so versatile. Can either play as a centre forward, play out on the left, even played out on the right. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Tite was to go with more or less the same. With the only change will be Gabriel Jesus, who they had to do without anyway in the knockout stages of that Copa America, because he got sent off for kung fu kicking a player from Chile, and Paquetá came in and did a really good job. Instant impact in terms of replacing him. So it's just absurd when you see the options that they've got. It's amazing when you watch kind of back-to-back Brazil games and you watch back-to-back Neymar games, you again appreciate just what an exceptional talent Neymar is. Just unreal in terms of his courage, bravery to just give me the ball and let me get the kicked out of me. It's remarkable. So yeah, looking forward to it, James. Looking forward to a bit of France. I know, you know, it's Tom's second country. So if he's got any Paris recommendations for me for the second game, whereas Julien Laurence is trying to make me out to be the Tunisia correspondent rather than the Brazil correspondent. So I am James Al Horncastle now on WhatsApp to him.
The first game is in Havre, is it not?
It is, yes, but I'm then coming back to
the Stade Océan.
The second game.
Yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it? The Brazil against ground. Ghana in a second division.
It's a lovely little stadium, actually, James. It's kind of loosely modelled on the Allianz Arena, kind of made out of translucent blue plastic rather than whatever they've got going on in Munich. I went there, I think, for its inaugural match. It was certainly Didier Deschamps' first game as France coach, was played in Le Havre, bizarrely, and they played out an absolutely dreadful 0-0 draw against Uruguay, which very much kind of set out Deschamps' stall for his tenure. But yeah, I'd recommend a little stroll around the harbour in Le Havre. It's very pretty.
This is famously where didn't Pogba and Grisou kind of drive back and go out nightclubbing one time and got banned for doing this? I can't remember. That's the kind of thing that I want to do on my way back from Le Havre.
Get banned for nightclubbing.
Yeah, well, Le Havre got a fantastic youth system, and that's where Pogba started out, of course.
There you go. Since losing the final of the Copa America last year, Brazil are on a 13-game unbeaten streak. They've drawn 3 of those matches, won the other 10, scoring 30 goals, conceding just 4. Tough opponents for Ghana on Friday. Right. James, listen, have a great time in Le Havre. Enjoy the nightlife.
Hardy Havre. Yeah, brilliant. Let's bring it.
Excellent. All right, catch up with you soon, big guy.
Okay. Short guy.
Yep, the little man. Yeah,
the little magician.
Excellent. Okay, more international delights on the way and a spot of On This Day as well.
Hello, I'm Lindsay Hooper, host of the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. After the euphoria of the Euros in the summer, the WSL is back with some massive shocks already. This weekend, there's some mouthwatering ties with a record crowd expected for the North London Derby at the Emirates. And it's Derby Day on Merseyside too. Plus, there's a titanic tussle in South London as Chelsea and Manchester City go head-to-head, both looking for their first points of the season. For all the insight and opinion you need, join me and our stat panel of experts this week and every week on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Listen for free and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
22nd of September, everybody, of course. On this day, 17 years ago, what happened? Why, only the worst debut ever in a football match. That's right, it was Jonathan Woodgate for Real Madrid against Athletic Club de Bilbao. A Woodgate, who you will recall, had been bought for a then sizable 13 and a bit million from Newcastle, but then hadn't played a single game in over a year for Real, his new club, because of injuries. Then finally got his chance on the 22nd of September 2005. Colin, what happened? And is it the stuff of legend in Spain as it is everywhere else?
Yeah, so Jonathan Woodgate, his debut for Real Madrid was remarkable. To score an own goal and to get sent off in the one game was just an absolute nightmare. And as you say, James, it was the fact that he had been signed from Newcastle as a player who the club were aware that he had injury issues. And the Real Madrid president, Florentino Perez, he had insisted, look, he's going to be playing within 3 weeks. Whenever he signed for the club. And obviously that didn't go to plan. And it was pushed back. It was 14 months almost until he made his debut. So this was a very, very, very long time in coming. And it was such a bizarre match as well, because Real Madrid fell behind 1-0 because of the own goal, and they came back to win 3-1. But it was a really, really strange game, because Woodgate actually played quite well, which sounds strange in the context of it, but he impressed the crowd. They actually applauded him after he got sent off, such was the manner of his performance. They also thought the red card was a little bit unlucky because it was 2 yellows, the second one was a little bit harsh. but it was the interview that Jonathan Woodgate gave to the English media after the game, which is quite good, whereby he was still sort of in shock from what had happened on the pitch, and he comes out after the game, he's like, oh, hell, my God, where do I start? I'm still in shock. An own goal and sent off. What a debut. What a debut. After the own goal in the yellow, I was thinking, Jesus Christ, just don't get sent off. And then I got sent off. So it was one of those whereby it really was a nightmare occasion in terms of the headlines, but it was played to this backdrop where he had worked so hard to get himself back in, and things had just gone wrong. But it's curious how he's sort of seen in Spain, and I was speaking to a couple of people about this. There doesn't seem to be any lasting legacy of this game in particular, but he did endear himself to quite a lot of people because he made an effort to learn Spanish, to speak Spanish, to give interviews in Spanish to the media, to travel about Spain to try to get used to the culture of it. And I think that's appreciated, especially coming from a UK perspective. And I mean, his performances generally were actually seen as being quite good. It was just the fact that he was always getting an injury setback, and that also ruled him out of the World Cup in 2006 for England. It's the fact that he just got injured again on the eve of that tournament. And obviously 4 years before that, he had been banned from England duty after the court case following the incident when he was at Leeds with Lee Bowyer. One thing I didn't know about Jonathan Woodgate is that he is the brother-in-law of Stuart Downing. And Woodgate was the assistant at Middlesbrough when Downing was the player there. And Downing then left the club to go to Blackburn whenever Woodgate became the manager. But I had not been aware that they were brothers-in-law. So yeah, that was quite an interesting little tidbit that I found when researching him.
All right. Did you also know that he was the scorer of the winning goal the last time Tottenham Hotspur won a trophy?
Yeah. That's one of the things as well, isn't it? It was the League Cup final against Chelsea, and I was sort of thinking about it. It was one of the moments that encapsulated his career, because Woodgate, I think it was that season, he played over 40 games for Spurs, and there was a sense that he's finally found a sort of right balance in terms of his fitness and avoiding injuries, and then he just got another injury setback the next season, and it was almost summed up his career, the fact that there was so much promise and there was so much excitement that this guy is such a great central defender, such potential, but just because of injuries and the way he was managed by various clubs, he just sadly never got a chance to really fulfil just how good he could have been.
Although, pretty good career. He won a League Cup. He won a trophy with Spurs, which not everyone gets to do. Went to Real Madrid, other things. So managed Bournemouth. Yeah, there you go, Jonathan Woodgate. All right, big teams on the brink of relegation in international football in the Nations League include France, who are facing Austria. Yep, world champions France. If they lose to Austria, they will be relegated. Build up to that match, clouded by a series of scandals around the French game. But also on the brink, Wales, who take on Belgium on Thursday night. A Belgium without Romelu Lukaku. How are Wales looking, Tom?
Yeah, missing a few key players, which is always the case. I mean, it affects all teams, but I think Wales in particular seem to struggle to get their key men out consistently. No Aaron Ramsey, no Joe Allen, no Ben Davis, no Harry Wilson. All of those would be probable starters if fit when the World Cup comes around. Gareth Bale is in the squad, having made a positive start to life in Los Angeles. They're managing his game time quite carefully, though. I think he's made 11 appearances, but only 2 starts or something like that. So the suggestion is that he is unlikely to start both of Wales' matches. And I think the hope from a Welsh perspective from these games is that we'll see more of the Wales that we saw in the World Cup playoff games against Austria and Ukraine, when they were very solid, when Gareth Bale made the difference, where they played with a lot of control and a lot of composure, and a bit less of the very kind of shaky looking Wales that we saw in the Nations League games that followed. I mean, Carl mentioned the Netherlands before. In both of Wales's Nations League games against the Netherlands in June, Wales equalised in stoppage time and then conceded the decisive goal in the game seconds later. I think Memphis Depay's winner in the 3-2 win in what was Wales' last game came something like 10 seconds after Wales had equalised. And I mean, at the time, you know, if you'd given Wales fans the option of qualifying for the World Cup and then, you know, losing all of those Nations League games 5-0, it's not a decision that would have taken very long to come to. I mean, you know, Wales fans were quite happy to write off those games because Robert Page was managing his squad and sharing the minutes around and, you know, making sure players were fit. But at the same time, and, you know, Scotland are in a similar position now, being on the verge of promotion to League A. For a small country like Wales, it's a huge thing to be in Nations League League A, and it would be a pity to just, you know, disappear from the top tier without a whimper. So, you know, as much as World Cup qualification was the obvious priority in the summer, it would be nice to see something from Wales in these two games, you know, partly to try and stave off relegation in the Nations League, and also just to give us all a little bit of belief heading into the World Cup, which is now, you know, suddenly feels like it's just around the corner.
In a group with England and USA and Iran. Colin, sorry.
No, as Colin said there about the Nations League group that Wales are in, I mean, that's a really difficult group to have Netherlands, Belgium and Poland as well. And Tom mentioned the two defeats against the Netherlands in the last minute. Wales took the lead away to Poland in the second half and still lost that game 2-1. So, I mean, all these games have been very close. They've been competitive. And I guess, as Tom sort of alluded to there as well, that Wales need to be a very sort of well-drilled team defensively. They need to be very well-disciplined.
Is it Danny Ward who's going to be between the posts for you, Tom? And if so, you know, the most regularly perforated keeper in the Premier League, how much of a concern is that?
I have never felt so much sympathy for a professional footballer, I don't think, in my entire life. He has a Jonathan Woodgate in almost every game, Danny Ward. And I find myself watching Leicester's games and praying that the opposition aren't going to shoot and praying that one of his teammates isn't going to roll the ball back to him, because he just looks so shaky. And it's awful because he's not a bad goalkeeper. Leicester paid £12 million to sign him from Liverpool. And when he's played for Wales, in the main, he's looked pretty solid. He has had the odd clanger, but he's never looked, you know, in as much difficulty as he has with Leicester. And obviously the fact that Leicester have had this very difficult start to the season, you know, with all the issues around the club, the lack of recruitment, this sort of, you know, huge funk that they're in, you know, he has really been in the firing line, which I guess if you're putting a positive spin on it, means he's getting lots of practice at the very least. The fact that he's having to face so many shots in a game. I mean, looking at the Wales goalkeeper situation, Danny Ward is now a regular starter for a Premier League club, and Wayne Hennessy, who is his main rival for a starting role with the national team, is not a regular starter for Nottingham Forest. But Hennessy's actually started three of Wales' last four games, all of those Nations League games in the summer. So I wonder whether he might end up taking over from Ward. I mean, it wouldn't appear to make a huge amount of sense, given that one is playing regularly in the Premier League and one isn't. But Wayne Hennessy has proved everything, you know, when it comes to Wales. He's overtaken Neville Southall as the country's most capped goalkeeper. And albeit he's not playing, you know, he's been part of the setup for so long. You know, he's great pals with Gareth Bale. He's part of that group of players who, you know, who achieved that miracle of reaching the semi-finals at Euro 2016. And I think, you know, that is reassuring from a Wales perspective that, yes, the nominal first choice is having a really rough time of it, but you couldn't hope for a more experienced, you know, better equipped number two. And, yeah, I think these two games in the Nations League will give us a good indication of whether it's going to be Hennessy or Ward starting between the posts in Qatar.
At the other end of the kind of group table, not that group, but Spain, taking on Switzerland on Saturday. Connor, just a quick word on Spain, because as you say, this is the last chance we'll get to see them before the World Cup. What kind of shape are they in?
Well, they've been in very good form since losing the Nations League final from a year ago. They've been unbeaten in the last eight matches. There seems to be a sense of continuity within squad selection, at least, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about how it will ultimately shape up for the World Cup. There's still no David De Gea. I know David De Gea's had a bit of a dip of form, of course, but there's still no Sergio Ramos, despite him now being a regular for PSG. Ansu Fati as well isn't in this squad, and there's quite a bit of debate around this because he's only started one game for Barcelona this season. There's a sense that he's had these long-term knee injury problems, and he's sort of come back from it the past 6 months. I think there's still a little bit of concern over whether he's fully overcome those issues and whether he's ready to step up. And if he was to miss out on the World Cup, it would be a, it would obviously be a huge blow for him, because he's such an exciting young player and he's someone who guarantees goals for club and country as well. So that's a bit of a concern. And another issue is Iago Aspas, who's really been the sort of top Spanish striker in La Liga for probably the past two or three seasons. And he just hasn't featured at all under Luis Enrique. He's still being excluded from the squad. And he gave an interview gave an interview earlier this week in Spanish radio, and he's like, you know, I don't understand why I'm not being selected. And he just said, like, I hope that it is a football decision, because I don't think there's anything personal between me and the manager, but I don't know. He couldn't explain it. And Gerard Moreno, Mikel Oyarzabal and Dani Olmo, they're all out injured for this round of international games. So there's been a couple of new call-ups. Nico Williams, who is the brother of Iñaki Williams, of course, he's not playing for Ghana. He's been called up for the first time. He's in really good form for Athletic de Bilbao. And Borja Iglesias, who's also, of course, known as the Panda. He's been in fantastic form for Real Betis over the past sort of 12, 18 months. He's got his first call-up too. So it'll be interesting to see if he's going to be given a chance in that sort of central striking role for Spain that has been, as we all know, the big issue over the past 3 or 4 years, with the sort of the form of Alvaro Morata comes and goes several times, often within the same game. And there's still a lot of question marks around this squad, even though there is a sense that Luis Enrique has certainly got them in the right direction and they're in very strong form.
Excellent. Oh, I mentioned earlier on Scotland on Wednesday night getting that 3-0 win over Ukraine at Hampden Park. John McGinn, and then a couple of headers from Lyndon Dykes, which means that Scotland are poised, as I think Colin was mentioning, for promotion to Ligue A of the Nations League. I think I've got my terminology right there. 2 points clear, Scotland at the moment. We've got two games coming up. Republic of Ireland on Saturday, and then next Tuesday, facing the Ukrainians again in Krakow.
John McGinn is a different footballer with Scotland. I mean, you were kind of used to seeing him in this three-man Aston Villa midfield, kind of, you know, hard-working, running the troops, throwing himself into tackles. And yet, for Scotland, he's like the number 10. He's got loads of freedom. He's got, like, you know, two holding midfielders behind him. And his goal-scoring record over the last, 2 years is phenomenal. And he is a player with an awful lot of technical quality. Lovely left foot, but it makes me think of John Obi Mikel a little bit when you think about players who seem to suddenly be transformed when they play for their national teams. And, you know, we kind of looked at John Obi Mikel as a kind of hard working holding midfielder, whereas when he played for Nigeria, he had the number 10 shirt on his back and he absolutely ran the show. One of the enjoyable little kind of quirks of international football.
Indeed so. All right, well, there you go. That's what's coming up this weekend in the Nations League and assorted friendlies as well. We'll be reviewing the outcomes of those matches and more on Monday. Next up, though, let's have a quick check on the WSL ahead of a particularly brilliant set of fixtures for the women's game.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This is The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
joined now by The Athletic's Charlotte Harper, ahead of a mouth-watering weekend in the WSL. Charlotte, I mean, leaping out at me is, first of all, the North London Derby at the Emirates on Saturday, and then Sunday's Merseyside Derby at Anfield. But there's loads of other treats in there as well.
There is. Brighton against Reading, West Ham, Man United, Leicester, Aston Villa, and, of course, Chelsea, Man City on Sunday. That'll be a cracker, that one.
North London Derby, though, how big is this, given the Gunners' current form?
It's a huge occasion, of course, but more importantly, it's being played at the Emirates. I believe around 47,000 tickets have been sold, and they're still kind of pushing for more. Arsenal have hit the ground running last week, beating Brighton 4-0. They drew against Ajax Toul, and I think that Champions League experience will really challenge Arsenal. It's only the second round of qualifying, so they'll go away to Ajax again. So they have been in great form, but that Toul draw against Ajax shows that they really need to be on the money. Art de Roche wrote a very insightful piece on their press and the fine margins that will make this Arsenal squad a better team in the future.
They were so strong at home last season. What hopes do you have for Spurs? Loved Ashley Neville's goal against Leicester for them last weekend.
Tottenham, Rianne Skinner has done a brilliant job with that side last year as well. And there'll be a tough test for Arsenal. It won't be easy by any means, but I think that's what we want from a North London derby, and especially to build the fan base at the Emirates. It will be, we want a tight fixture. You don't want Tottenham just to roll over, and they certainly won't do that.
What about on Sunday then, on Merseyside, as newly promoted Liverpool take on Everton after a... Would you call that the result of the opening weekend, their victory over defending champions Chelsea?
Along with Aston Villa's 4-3 win against Manchester City, yes, that was a surprise. Both results, if you'd said that at the beginning of the season, I wouldn't have believed you. Liverpool conceded the first penalty within the third minute, a Stonewall penalty. It was spot on from the referee, Emily Heaslip, and Frank Kirby converted, and you think 3 minutes, Liverpool are down here. Chelsea had an opportunity to double their lead, but Sam Kerr's goal was ruled offside. Liverpool were lucky to get away with that one. Looking back, it looked onside. And then Liverpool get back in it. 1-1, a Millie Bright handball. Liverpool forcing the error from, you know, Megan Campbell's extremely technically adept throw-ins. If you haven't seen them, they're like catapults launched in. And again, Chelsea should have dealt with that much better than they did. Katie Stengel converted from the spot. And you think, wow, Liverpool are back in this. And 20 minutes later, it's clear penalty. Great positioning again from the referee. Buchanan comes across and Liverpool force that error. And Stengel once again steps up, and you think, were Liverpool lucky? You know, you always need a bit of luck, but they took the game to Chelsea, and Chelsea just weren't clinical enough in that final third. Liverpool had 31% possession, and they'll be expecting more against Everton at Anfield on Sunday. It'll be a big occasion for them. They haven't played in front of that many fans. But don't discount Everton either. I spoke to Brian Sorensen at Finch Farm a couple of weeks ago, and that squad has had a complete overturn in terms of incomings and outgoings. But it's time that Everton need, after their hugely disappointing season last year, in which they finished 10th after kind of aspirations to qualify for the Champions League.
8 games without a win now in the league for Everton, but this would be a great time to end that particular run. Chelsea, after that shock defeat to Liverpool last time around, are going to be taking on Man City, which is huge, particularly after what Man City got up to last weekend.
Yes, it's a real interesting scenario at Manchester City with the exodus of players. They're missing Georgia Stanway, Kira Walsh, Lucy Bronze, Caroline Weir. So a real hole in their squad. They have recruited young, talented European players, but it will be really interesting to see how Manchester City come up against Chelsea And, you know, these are international players who have Champions League experience. It's a mouth-watering tie for the neutral.
Magnificent. Charlotte, thank you so much for that. And you'll be rounding all that up next week?
I will be. I'm currently exploring an interesting case with Paris Saint-Germain women. So that will be the main focus. And we'll see how that one goes.
Yes, the extraordinary case of the assault on a PSG player, which is, I mentioned earlier on some of the scandals that are currently surrounding French football, but this is one of the chief ones. Tom, you must have been all over this.
Yeah, I followed it, but I mean, I think that the piece you need to read for background is the piece that Charlotte did when the story first broke. I mean, it's the most comprehensive piece I read on it in either the English or French media. So that'll be a good little background. But yeah, it's suddenly burst back into the headlines this week with fresh revelations with Aminata Diallo, who was the teammate of Keira Hamrouis, who was initially detained and then released, being detained again and then released again, but once again in the crosshairs of the investigators. And yeah, it's a pretty unsavoury story, every day that a new element comes out, you find yourself scratching your head. It's a pretty remarkable case.
Where are we at now on it, Charlotte?
So yesterday there was a statement from the public prosecutor. So Diallo was charged on September the 16th with 3 counts of aggravated violence and criminal conspiracy. She's now placed under judicial supervision by the judge. And she has certain obligations to abide by, such as staying at her father's home, handing over her passport, reporting weekly to the police station. She's not allowed to contact co-perpetrators or accomplices, cannot contact the victim, Keira Hamrouis, cannot contact witnesses, and in particular members of the PSG football team. So, yes, this story continues. Diallo has consistently denied any involvement, and Keira Hamrouis still has 1 year left of her PSG contract. There were reports from the French media that she has met up and will resume group training with the squad. She was at the Champions League game last night. Aminata Diallo's contract was not extended, so she is no longer a player at PSG.
Extraordinary case following the assault on the PSG star and the various accusations which have been flying ever since, which took a really bizarre turn when Eric Abidal was kind of drawn into the whole thing with disastrous consequences for his marriage. But anyway, yeah, well, look forward to finding out what actually happened there and then PSG being able to put it all behind them. So you'll have a piece out on that next week, will you, Charlotte?
That depends, James. Depends how my day goes today.
Okay, all right.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, that is the plan. So
all right.
Hold me to that because I need to stay accountable to get it over the line.
Charlotte Harper there, who you can, of course, follow at theathletic.com. Carl, what have you got coming up for people on theathletic.com?
A breakdown of the England kits, as previously discussed.
And oh, yeah.
Why they just a little bit lacking for me, unfortunately.
All right, then. Fair enough. Colin, anything special?
Well, it depends on the fallout from these results and whatever narrative takes me. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Tom, what's in the works, Shea Williams?
A few irons in the fire.
Nice.
A few irons in the fire, that's all I'll say. Nothing that will be published anytime soon, but that's stuff coming up.
Brilliant.
Further down the line.
Are you writing a book, good man?
That would be telling.
Well, of course, you've got all of the up-to-date reaction and hot takes to the weekend's action at theathletic.com and by following these fine people on social media as well. For now, though, that's it for this Totally Football Show. We're back on Monday with our thoughts on all the stuff that just happened. So do join us for that. So rest assured, even if you don't watch all of the international football, you'll be able to find out exactly what happened. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody, and catch you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following The Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.